North Face doesn't make anything. They don't even own a sewing machine. Somebody else made all of their product. Patagonia doesn't make anything. It's made for them.
That's not an accusation. It's just how the outdoor industry works. The big names design gear, and someone else, usually a factory on the other side of the Pacific, builds it. I'm Brody Wilson, and this is Local Motion. For the next half hour, we're going to stay close to home and look at what happens when somebody decides to make the thing themselves, here in Western Colorado. What that costs, what it requires, and who specifically does the work. We're going to start in a building in Montrose, where a company called Jagged Edge Mountain Gear cuts and sews backpacks and jackets. Later in the show, KBNF's Lisa Young takes us across town to a manufacturer working on a very different problem. If you're not able to stick around for the next half an hour, no worries. You can always listen by looking for Local Motion under the news tab at kbnf.org or by searching for KBNF Local Motion on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or even YouTube. We hope you enjoy the show. Jagged Edge starts somewhere smaller than a building. It starts with a cart.
Jagged Edge was started in the early 90s by some twin sisters who lived in Telluride at the time, Paula and Margaret Quenamoan. And they started sewing fleece headbands, and they would sell them out of a little push cart on Main Street.
That's Eric Dalton. He owns and operates Jagged Edge now, but he didn't start it, and he's careful to say so. The sisters grew that push cart into something substantial. Stores in Telluride and Ouray, Crested Butte, Mountain Village, Salt Lake City. A catalog business, back when a catalog was how you actually reached people. And then the early 2000s arrived.
Right after 9/11 happened, they were a little bit over-leveraged in everything that they were trying to do, and that's kind of when the ownership changed into my hands as far as the store in Telluride went. They were basically going to just shut the store down, and my family's had retail stores in Telluride for a long time. My mom was an old retailer, so she was good friends with the sisters and thought, hey, you know, why don't we we'll offer to take over the shop, we'll buy your existing inventory. And you know, and at that point the Quenamoan sisters had partnered with a pretty big national brand, and they sold them the trademark actually to Jagged Edge Mountain Gear.
The national brand had plans.
But unfortunately, that only lasted about 6 months, and they kind of shuttered the, let go of the twins and some other folks that they had hired from Jagged Edge, which was super unfortunate. And the brand was just kind of shuttered and put on a shelf.
So Dalton had a store in Telluride with the name gone. He spent the next decade getting it back.
It took me about 10 years to get that trademark back.
Getting the name back was one thing. Making something with it was another. And there was an obvious way to do that. Design the gear here, have it built overseas, and ship it home. That's the standard path, and it's standard because it works. Dalton had met a designer named Kurt Gray at an industry trade show. Gray had spent years as a freelance outerwear designer, flying to factories in Asia, by his count, 35 times. So when the two of them sat down to talk about bringing the brand back, they both knew exactly what the easy version looked like. I asked Gray why they didn't take it, though.
You mentioned that you had it made domestically. Why?
That's what we believe in.
Say that again, please.
That's what we believe in.
Think globally and sew locally.
For Dalton, the reasoning ran through the valley that he lives in.
I'd rather hire local employees and local folks, and it all comes with a cost. It's all a trade-off, right, in different ways. But that was really important to me, and no one else was doing it. I just thought, how are we going to be this little brand kind of coming back from the ashes, so to say? And why are we going to stand out if we're just kind of following the same model of everything else? And, you know, you look at our great valley we're in, all the food that's grown locally, all the agriculture, all the animal products. I mean, it's just something that I think people appreciate. And maybe, you know, we're starting to cross that bridge over into consumer type products. But we're really proud that we try to use everything that we can. It's sourced domestically. Domestically, it's made here. We're paying local people.
One consequence of cutting your own fabric is that you're left holding the parts that you didn't use.
We turn scrap into bags. We make thousands of bags every year out of our cutting scrap.
Awesome.
That doesn't happen. I used to fly to Asia. I've been to Asia 35 times and overseas and da-da-da-da. And that does not happen there.
To understand why scrap piles up in Montrose and not in Asia, you have to look at the cutting table itself. So we walked out onto the floor and Jagged Edge's facility in North Montrose.
And right now we are hand cutting this stuff. We hand cut everything that we make, which is fantastic from a making sure the fabric's in good shape and kind of quality control. But you can imagine you're incredibly limited by your efficiency of being able to do that. So for us to make 50 backpacks, that's quite a feat. Each backpack is hand cut out of fabric. So and that's just step one. In the 50 steps it takes to put that bag together. So
50 steps per bag, and the first one is a person with a pattern and a blade. The arithmetic drives everything else about how this shop works, including what it buys. And here, Gray makes a point that reorganized how I think about gear. In an overseas factory, he says the expensive input is the cloth, labor is the cheap part, so the whole system is built to save fabric.
In this country, it's the other way around. The labor is way more expensive than the textile. In Asia, they're doing everything they can to limit the cost of the textile. Number two, you need to understand that we buy our own materials and make our product. Asian make, those factories bought those materials and then sold that package to the Americans. So in very many times, that factory selected those linings in that bag that failed. The factory sourced those fabrics. That factory paid their money for it.
That's worth sitting with for a minute. When a pack wears out at the lining, the person who chose that lining may not have been the designer whose name is on it. It may have been the factory itself solving its own cost problem. Buying your own cloth solves that. It also introduces a problem of its own, which Dalton showed me standing in front of his fabric shelves. Their apparel fabric comes from Polartec in Massachusetts, and Polartec does not sell in small quantities.
Polartec doesn't just print you out 10 yards of fabric and ship it to you in the color you want. You got to buy 500 yards, something like that. So that's a big reach
color,
for us right now.
You have to buy by color minimum.
Yep. So we have to meet color minimums. We often shop excess fabric. So when Patagonia cuts, they buy tons of fabric from Polartec. Polartec makes all this fabric for them. Guess what? They wound up with 500 extra yards. That's where a brand like us, we're coming in and swooping that 500 extra yards. We don't always get to pick the color. Sometimes it's, okay, this is the fabric we want. Guess what? They only have it left in black and gray. That's kind of, what we're choosing from.
So now you can picture it. The company that owns the sewing machines buys the leftover yardage of a company that doesn't own any sewing machines and takes whatever colors still on the roll. I asked both Dalton and Gray, what makes manufacturing hard here specifically? Not politically, just practically. What's difficult about making physical objects in rural Western Colorado? The first answer was distance.
We have to buy our own machines. We are far away. Denver is the closest sewing machine resource. If something breaks, if we're having problems, sometimes that means trucking a machine up to Denver or Kurt's fixing it himself. And
the second answer was equipment that they can't reach: laser cutting, seam welding, seam taping, the technologies that would let a small shut cut 50 backpacks without 50 hand cuts. And that costs more than the building that they're sitting in. Gray says there's a model for that problem, and it's in Detroit.
Little makers need to be able to share the technologies. Are you familiar with, maybe not, the ISAIC program out of Detroit, ISAIC, Industrial Sewing and Innovation Center? ISAIC is a training program in Detroit where they are taking people that want to learn to sew, and you can actually get certified as a machine operator in this country through the Department of Labor, and they're putting them through programs so they become certified operators, and then those operators go to the manufacturers in the Minneapolis area.
Companies that compete with each other fund the center together. They put in machines that no single one of them could justify, and they train people, because that's the third answer, and it's the one that kept coming up.
This country's lost its institutional knowledge about sewing, and what it knows of sewing isn't the way it is anymore. It's changed. As I've said before, sewing's changed just like power tools have changed. Imagine what power tools looked like in the 80s. Yeah, they don't look like that anymore. And sewing's the same sort of technological track. It's completely different now. But what our institutional memory of it is from the 80s and 90s, when there was a large sewing base here.
which leaves a shop like Jagged Edge hiring for a skill that the country mostly stopped teaching.
You know, it's like finding literally a needle in a haystack to find someone in our Western Colorado community who you know, maybe has a comfort around a sewing machine and wants to learn more and go down this path. For a big brand to all of a sudden spend $44 million in opening a sew factory in California, I mean, it would take them a lot of training to get people right. up. And who do you get to train? As Kurt said, a lot of this institutional knowledge has just evaporated from this country. And I'm not saying those people aren't out there, but it's, again, like finding a needle in the haystack of how do you get your labor force at a scale? That's how we're able to do it. Because we have a couple sewers, and we hold them, and we treat them right, and we make them part of our family.
And speaking to this challenge that's facing all manufacturers in the U.S., whether tool and die or injection molding or sewing, Kurt Gray says.
It's a generation before that factory's any good.
I want to be clear about scale here, because it's easy to hear manufacturer and picture a whole floor of people. Standing in the shop, I asked about how many people are actually sewing here.
There's about two or three of us. Well, actually, there's sort of four now. Because we'll cut here. Josh makes an Hesperus, and then he'll come back and forth and finish things here.
Cool.
I will sew here. You saw Dylan come and go.
Yeah.
This is not a huge sewing floor making thousands and thousands of bags and garments. When we started a tour of the space, Kurt Gray started at a machine called a clicker, a press that stamps shapes out of heavy material with a steel die. Jagged Edge uses it to cut the padded straps that go on their packs, but they didn't buy it brand new.
So there was a shoe manufacturer here in Montrose. State of Motion, was that what it is?
Sense of Motion.
They were making Vibram soled shoes here in Montrose. And unfortunately,
there's a pair right there.
And there we go.
oh, cool.
They closed up shop. But this was clicker that they were using to actually take the Vibram rubber. And they'd put a die in there, a cutter die, and they would click out those soles. So
this is a shoe clicker. That's why the field's so big.
Wow.
So we use this clicker to click out backpack straps, the foam, the parts and pieces that go into our backpack.
A shoe factory in Montrose closed. Its cutting press is still running in Montrose, roughly three blocks away, cutting backpack straps instead of soles. That's the thing about a manufacturing town. The companies come and go, and the machines and the people who know how to run them tend to stay. Near the end of our conversation, I told Eric Dalton and Kurt Gray that this piece wasn't only about them, that we wanted to look at making things across the Western Slope. I asked, who else should I talk to? Gray didn't hesitate.
Oh, in this town, they make everything from bricks to screws for satellites.
Tell me.
Go talk to the Swiss screw guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's making $1,000 screws, right? He's here because of the CNC machines that were here for Ross Reels. He knew the operators were here. He followed the labor. Montrose is where your plow got welded and your teeth got drilled. And I mean, Montrose is where the entire corner of the state would come for those resources. And it's always been that way here. This town is crazy that way. There's the Montrose Manufacturing Association that meets monthly.
A monthly meeting of people who make things in a town of about 21,000. That's pretty cool. And whether it's Swiss-O-Matic making screws for satellites, Ross Reels or Scott Fly Rods in the fly fishing industry, or Secret Creek making yurts, also Dragon Armor Shingles up in Hodgkiss. There are manufacturers all over the Western Slope, and many of them are facing similar issues. We'll hear from another local manufacturer in the second half of this Locomotion. You're listening to Local Motion, KVNF's weekly public affairs program where we hear from the voices that are shaping life on the Western Slope every day. Today, we're talking all about manufacturing on the Western Slope and the often scrappy, innovative, and persistent approaches that people are taking to making physical goods that people want to buy. Another manufacturer in town is a company called Geyser Systems, and it has spent the last few years doing something that Jagged Edge would recognize, rebuilding itself around what it could actually make at the scale it could actually make it. Geyser started with a camping shower. Its newer work is a pair of portable handheld shower systems, the Geyser Clean Kit for consumers and the Geyser Field Shower Kit developed for military use. Getting there meant giving up an entire product line and an entire production crew. KBNF freelance reporter Lisa Young went to see how it works.
Jonathan Ballesteros wasn't planning to become a rural manufacturer. However, one big idea during an overlanding trip to the Australian outback changed everything. After weeks without a proper shower and a pending blind date, he asked a question that would change the course of his life and birth a small manufacturing business.
Long story short, I was really out of frustration saying, I've got to find a way to make the most of every drop of water in my rig. And that question of how do I do that really dawned on me as something that could apply not just in the outdoor camping world, but in various situations where water scarcity is a serious thing. So I decided with all my heart, soul, and might to find an answer to that question and came up with our first of five products. The flagship Geyser system is a outdoor camping and really vehicle camping product that turns 0.8 gallons into a 15-minute shower. So there's a lot of customers who use that to shower themselves, clean their dogs before their dogs get into the van or a car, and are able to maintain hygiene with minimal water. The product was wildly successful when we launched it in 2020, got launched into all REI stores, which historically in the outdoor camping world was a pretty big deal. The only company that got launched in all REI stores at the same time was BioLite. And it was great. It was a top rated product for years. And then since then, we've been able to launch various products that help address water scarcity in various situations.
That desert moment eventually became Geyser Systems, a tiny Western Slope startup in Montrose with the mission to build a water-saving shower system for the overlanding, RVing, and camping communities. When Geyser's original shower system debuted in 2020 with national distributor REI, demand grew fast. However, scaling up production in rural Montrose County wasn't simple, and much of the outdoor gear market was in decline, affecting Geyser's bottom line. In its first few years, the expanding company became more dependent on outsourced traditional plastic injection modeling used in the camping shower system that required large upfront cost. Gesturing toward a Geyser system shower sitting on his warehouse shelf, Ballesteros explained the dilemma.
You look at our flagship product. That over there has got a bunch of plastic injection molded parts, the black top and the black bottom. For us to actually get a plastic injection molding machine running, you have to do a higher volume. Our supplier for those components says, hey, an MOQ, minimum order quantity of 1,000. And really, I mean, even then, the cost per part is still a little too high. We have to actually order 2,000 at a time. Huge outlays of cash, the financing of which is a real strain from our balance sheets and our profit and loss.
In addition to fulfilling the REI contract, a dedicated Geyser team drove thousands of miles to trade shows, demos, and meetings with the outdoor gear market, only to realize that the return on their investment wasn't enough to sustain or grow the company.
We went out to trade shows to understand a little bit more about what's happening to the RV market. We got a chance to pitch it to the CEO of Thor Industries and their advanced R&D groups. And it was really cool and interesting. But where things took the most interesting turn was when we had a real honest conversation about what's it like to manufacture for the outdoor gear industry. We were doing around 38,000 miles a year, going to various trade shows, educating people how to use our product. And it was doing well, but it was not enough volume for us to actually scale to the point where we needed to scale. And, you know, when people get educated on our product and actually see it in action, they fall in love with it. Sometimes they get a chance to use our product in one of our shower trailers. So we've been to like the Telluride Bluegrass Festival and let, you know, give people showers after like a fun day festiving all day long. And so people walk out of our shower trailer saying like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I took a full shower with half a gallon of water, and they end up buying the product. But the reality is, you know, the outdoor gear industry has been tapering, especially after the COVID times. And, you know, people, I would say have probably scaled back, especially with higher gas prices on their outings in the camping side. And so, and the reality is, I would say the outdoor gear industry, while it's always a very special place in our heart, it's just not a big enough problem for us to solve.
With a bigger water problem to solve, Ballesteros made a heart-wrenching decision to downsize his facility and eliminate his entire production crew. Now, with a smaller footprint and a few dedicated folks, Geyser is moving forward with what could be the biggest, smallest breakthrough for the company's manufacturing future, a 3D printed product that has crossover appeal with everyday consumers and larger contractors. The latest Geyser product is a handheld shower system. The system can use various sized water containers while running the small built-in pump with any 5-volt USB battery. The device recently went through testing for military usage.
This product that you're holding in your hands right now got tested by 100 soldiers in the most austere, rigorous wartime condition at Fort Irwin, the National Training Center. And when we came back from that pilot program, soldiers were like, you have no idea how this changes everything. Like, this is the best. And one soldier said, this is the best invention in the history of the Army. Leadership came to me and said, I could immediately tell which soldiers were using your product and which soldiers were not, just by the way they walked, by the way they interacted with other soldiers. And these are like young kids, you know, like 18-year-olds who are driving like huge tanks and dealing with crazy conditions. And, you know, when I came back to get some product feedback from them and give them some surveys, I witnessed 5,000 soldiers coming back from the box who were just, it was like a sea of misery watching and seeing them come back from a 2 to 4 week period of time in desert conditions, dusty, lack of sleep, of course, very poor hygiene. And this product absolutely changed the game for them. What's even more interesting is not just hearing, you know, those who are in the field, but even those who are of higher rank, you know, a general who got a chance to see this product in action with like a demo within 45 seconds. He immediately saw this and said, man, soldiers need this. You know, our men and women who are in uniform, in military, they're seeing a global perspective that I only got a chance to see once when I went down to Mexico City and went into some neighborhoods that were really dealing with water scarcity. And so it's really interesting to hear their perspective, not only as it applies to them, but even in the populations that they interact with, and how much the world would benefit from a product that's way more affordable, way more compact, 10 times more energy efficient. So we're not only just in water conservation, but we're also in energy conservation as well. And, you know, this new product has been, since the last time you and I have spoke, has been really like the reinvention of our company.
Hospital systems are also becoming interested in the smaller portable sponge shower units.
Montrose Regional Hospital, when they saw this, the chief nursing officer, Coral Ann, said, I want you to meet the directors of our nursing departments. And I carefully like listened to all of them tell me about what are their patients and their nurses dealing with when it comes to maintaining hygiene for patients who are, you know, they're in bed for 7 days and the nursing staff is short, they're time crunched, and they may need an easier way to give their patient baths. So what I was really surprised about with this product was, while it originally, it made sense, hey, somebody who's backpacking could take a Nalgene bottle and, you know, take a shower with it. It took us into the military. It took us to hospital systems. And, you know, these two markets alone are way bigger than the outdoor gear industry. And so we're really at a very exciting time as a manufacturer.
With in-house 3D printing, Geyser can manufacture hundreds of handheld units at a time. They can make design changes on the fly, and they can avoid the crushing financial burden of outsourcing materials that ramp up their cost. A smaller, more agile product that takes far less manufacturing materials and will utilize a nimble assembly team gives Geyser a fighting chance. With the latest retooling at Geyser Systems, they now have access to markets far larger than the outdoor RV camping industry, and the company plans to bring back a next-generation version of its flagship Geyser shower system, aiming for 2027. All these changes could potentially mean adding new employees to the mix. Until then, Ballesteros has a few more hoops to jump through with the military contracts.
Where we are right now in terms of military contracts is we're collecting the entrants and we are taking, let's say, the initial steps to validate, which having two white paper studies from two different pilot programs and two national training centers with two totally different wartime conditions, it starts to really build up the story and justification of how much this is actually needed by our military. And so from there, we're going to start collecting more and more orders. At some point, we aspire, and we're currently taking the steps towards a 6 to 12 month process in which we will obtain a national stock number. So what that is the Defense Logistics Agency, essentially the central buying, let's say, team or group who conducts business with the supply base for all branches of military, they will assign, upon approval and review, a national stock number to expedite and make it easier for soldiers to procure our product. And just to give you an idea, if a national stock number gets assigned to this product, or when it does get assigned to this product, it'll be as easy as just a click of a button for a soldier to procure it. At that point, when we do get an NSN assigned to us, absolutely, we're going to need more sewing machines, we're going to need more table space, we're going to need more 3D printers, and we're going to definitely need more people to help us assemble. And this will be I anticipate, a small but definitely growing corner of the manufacturing base here in Montrose, Colorado.
Scaling up to meet new demands for future military and hospital contracts while reintroducing their flagship product from rural Colorado remains an ongoing challenge for Ballesteros and Geyser Systems.
That is a picture of what it means to be a manufacturer here on the Western Slope. You've heard about the trials and tribulations of just two of the many companies that are daring to make goods in a challenging market in a location that doesn't always make things easier. Special thanks in this episode, of course, to Eric Dalton and Kurt Gray at Jagged Edge Mountain Gear, and to Jonathan Ballesteros at Geyser Systems. Lisa Young reported the second half of today's show. I'm Brody Wilson, and this has been Local Motion on KBNF. And if you missed a portion of this show, you can always go back and re-listen by looking for Local Motion under the News tab at KBNF, or by listening in your podcast feed on Spotify, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening today. Have a good one.